Following are comments on Shakespeare's Henry V, Chorus and Act II. All the youth of England are on fire. The chorus says King Henry V's prospective war is popular with young men. Preparations are underway, but peril surrounds the king. The French have bribed three English aristocrats close to Henry to assassinate him. The chorus for Act II sets forth a tableau in which, quote-unquote, all the youth of England are on fire, and there is vast care and expenditure in preparation for the coming expedition. Chorus 2, line 1. War is the style, the fashion, the rage. The chorus speaker well describes the unrealistic optimism that usually reigns in a nation on the eve of a war, before the killing and dying start. Just as men marched cheerfully into the first engagements of World War I, having no inkling of the horrors of trench warfare, and many Americans during the presidency of George W. Bush believed the overly optimistic line that our armed forces would be greeted as liberators once Iraq was defeated, so did thousands of medieval Englishmen ready themselves gallantly for what they probably thought would be a short, profitable conflict across the Channel. King Henry's readying of his forces while still in England frightens the French, says the chorus, so they resort to a plot to assassinate the English king. They've bribed three English noblemen to do the deed, Richard, Earl of Cambridge, Henry, Lord Scrope of Masham, and Sir Thomas Grey, Knight of Northumberland. Like some of Henry IV's foes, these men meant to install Edmund Mortimer, 5th Earl of March, 1391-1425, as king, but apparently Edmund himself, who would at the time in 1415 have been around 24 years old, tipped Henry off as to what was coming. The king has traveled to the port town of Southampton, where we playgoers will be expected to imagine ourselves, after an initial trip to London's Eastcheap, where Falstaff's favorite tavern lies, and he lies sick within it, while we wait for the potentially dire murder plot to be resolved. Then it will be off with us to France, with a gentle pass promised by our guide, the chorus, who is enjoying a bit of pleasantry at the expense of the neoclassical unities. Chorus 2, line 39. He will bypass all strictures on time and place while causing no seasick stomachs. All in all, we moderns may feel a bit like the first visitors to Agincourt Park, able to observe and enjoy what present themselves as scenes of heroism and carnage at no risk to ourselves. The fearsome Battle of Agincourt is, after all, one of the most riveting moments in English history, and remained so even though the English hold on France continued to be tenuous after it, and lasted little longer than the short life of Henry V himself. The king hath run bad humors on the night. In Eastcheap, Henry's old companions, Pistol and Nym, nearly come to blows. Bardolph stops their quarreling, and the hostess, Mistress Quickly, reports that Falstaff is mortally ill. In Act II, Scene 1, Pistol and Nym quarrel at the tavern in Eastcheap over Nell Quickly, whom Pistol has married, and about a debt Nym wants to collect from Pistol. Act II, Scene 1, lines 15 through 17. At first, Pistol says only, quote-unquote, base is the slave that pays. Act 2, Scene 1, line 89. As always, he is full of bombastic talk. But we also learn that he plans to become the camp sutler, seller of camp provisions. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 42 through 45. This will be his way of operating as a war profiteer. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 99 through 104. Hostess Quickly informs everyone that Falstaff is dying, telling them, quote-unquote, as ever you come of women, come in quickly to Sir John. Ah, poor heart, he is so shaked of a burning quotidian tertian that it is most lamentable to behold. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 109 through 111. Nym reminds us that the gregarious, carefree Prince Hal, who consorted with him, has undergone a moral and status-based transformation as deep as death, too, and it has been devastating to Falstaff. As Nym says, quote unquote, "The king hath run bad humors on the knight." Act 2, Scene 1, line 113. "The mercy that was quick in us but late, by your own counsel is suppressed and killed." Henry foils a plot involving his companions, Scrope, Grey, and Cambridge. Confronting them in Southampton, he imposes immediate death sentences in the name of the realm and turns his attention to war in France. In Act 2, Scene 2, the treasonous plot of Scrope, Grey, and Cambridge is revealed before Henry's assemblage in Southampton, and they are denounced and sent to their deaths. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 39 through 81. It must be painful, if instructive, for Henry to listen to these men urge extreme harshness against an offender who verbally abused the king a short while ago, when they themselves would do much worse. So when Scrope, Grey, and Cambridge are exposed and liable to sentencing, Henry tells them, quote unquote, "The mercy that was quick in us but late by your own counsel is suppressed and killed." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 77 through 78. Scrope's participation in the dastardly plot is most painful of all to Henry, since the two men were apparently close friends. Henry laments, quote unquote, "May it be possible that foreign hire could out of thee extract one spark of evil that might annoy my finger." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 98 through 100. The best Henry can do here is to understand that the doctrine we know as, quote-unquote, the king's two bodies, must be applied. That is, the ordinary mortal Henry doesn't take the threat personally. But in his person, he also embodies the realm of England. And because these guilty men threatened the realm when they threatened him, they must pay the ultimate price. King Henry explains to the condemned men, quote-unquote, "Touching our person, seek we no revenge, but we our kingdom's safety must so tender, whose ruin you have sought, that to her laws we do deliver you." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 173 through 176. With this declaration, Henry's transformation from a private, prodigal son to a public man, a genuine king, is complete. He now turns to preparations for war in France. All was as cold as any stone. King Henry's old tavern friends eulogize Sir John Falstaff and mourn his passing. Pistol again reveals that he is a war profiteer, not a soldier, as he, Bardolph, Nym, and a boy depart for France. In Act 2, Scene 3, Pistol tells the tavern audience that Falstaff is dead. In practical terms, he says, that means, quote unquote, "We must earn, therefore," Act 2, Scene 3, line 6, "they must fend for themselves, not depend on the knight to do their planning for them." Hostess quickly speaks with great affection about Falstaff and recounts his dying moments, ending with, quote unquote, "all was as cold as any stone," Act 2, Scene 2, line 23. See lines 9 through 23 inclusive. Falstaff makes his last vow of repentance. We may remember his fitful gestures towards remorse in the Henry IV plays and the Merry Wives of Windsor, and seems to be as serious as his tenuous hold on reality will allow. As the Norton editor's footnote 4 to page 808 points out, Sir John, though the hostess doesn't recognize the text, recites part of Psalm 23, verse 2 of which, in the Geneva Bible, runs, quote unquote, "He maketh me to rest in green pasture and leadeth me by the still waters." See BibleGateway.com, 1599 Geneva Bible. Touching as this recounting is, old Sir John is a remnant of King Henry's past. In a sense, Hal, too, is dead, succeeded by an austere young man wielding a king's awesome power. The text affords Falstaff's companions and us, the audience, our moment of grief, and then we must let him go. It has been a long odyssey for Jack Falstaff, from Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, his happier times, to The Merry Wives of Windsor, wherein the impecuniousness that began in Henry IV, Part 2, makes him meaner than we want him to be, and finally, to heartbreak and death in Henry V. Pistol's intentions about the wars to come are none too honorable. He says, quote unquote, "Let us to France, like horse leeches, my boys, to suck, the very blood to suck." Act 2, Scene 3, lines 46 through 47. Pistol and his ilk are parasites who will make their way by afflicting their military host. This third scene marks our farewell not only to Falstaff, but in effect to his whole crew. There is some humor ahead, but in the main, it will not be their task to deliver it. "He is bred out of that bloody strain that haunted us in our familiar paths." Charles VI and his advisors planned France's defense against Henry V's forces. Exeter presents the French king with his nephew's claim to the French throne and hurls defiance at the Dauphin. In Act 2, Scene 4, Charles VI, who would be late middle-aged at 47 during the action at Agincourt in 1415, returns his counselor's memories to the first major strife between France and England, the victories of Edward the Black Prince at Crecy in 1346 and Poitiers in 1356. He sees the continuity of English stock and valor. Quote unquote, "Think we King Harry strong, and princes, look you strongly armed to meet him. The kindred of him hath been fleshed upon us, and he is bred out of that bloody strain that haunted us in our familiar paths." Act 2, Scene 4, lines 48 through 52. The description is no doubt mingled with fear. Charles VI admonishes the Dauphin and the constable alike to be wary of this youthful English king, so late considered a ne'er-do-well. He all but pleads with them to, quote-unquote, "fear the native mightiness and fate of him." Act 2, Scene 4, lines 63 through 64. Most of the French nobility we hear from, however, do not follow the old king's advice, least of all his hot-headed son and heir, the Dauphin. Exeter soon arrives and levies a stern demand on Henry V's behalf. To the French king, he declares, "Henry, quote-unquote, bids you then resign your crown and kingdom, indirectly held from him, the native and true challenger." Act 2, Scene 4, lines 93 through 95. The Dauphin scorns this demand and tries to justify his earlier gift, saying, quote-unquote, "matching to his youth and vanity, I did present him with the Paris balls." Act 2, Scene 4, lines 130 through 131. The French king doesn't share the young man's attitude, and Exeter's comeback in Henry's defense is effective. "Once a prodigal," admits Exeter on Henry's behalf, quote unquote, "now he weighs time even to the utmost grain." Act 2, Scene 4, lines 137 through 138. No one is playing any more at tennis or otherwise. Exeter's speech is by no means devoid of the usual tricks of martial rhetoric, most opprobrious of which is his brazen attempt to displace all responsibility for the coming waves of death, rapine, and destruction onto King Charles VI of France and his counselors. Exeter bids Charles, quote unquote, "to take mercy on the poor souls for whom this hungry war opens his vasty jaws." Act 2, Scene 4, lines 103 through 105. This personification is evasive since it is, after all, King Henry V who has made a dubious, adventurous claim to the French throne and then set sail to bring fire and sword to that wealthy and populous nation. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Tuesday, November 4th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.